You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park. This podcast is called The Story of Woman. That name was chosen deliberately. I didn't call it The Story of Women. I didn't call it The Story of Some Women. I chose Story of Woman because the word woman is really interesting to me. What does the word mean? When I say woman, what does that mean? Does that mean only white middle-class women in the Western history books that I've read about? Does that mean women who are heteronormative and live in similar ways whose stories resonate with me? No. Woman is so much bigger. Gender is so complicated. Life is so complicated. And when I think of stories, when I think of stories of women, the story of woman, it's not just a story of one woman evolving easily from ape into hominid into human. Evolution is messy. It's not a linear line. It is a tangle and a knot, hidden and twisted and buried, waiting to be unearthed. And when I think the story about the stories of women, I think about everybody out there listening. Every single one of you has a story. Every single one. And what drives me crazy is I won't ever know them all. When you think about all there is to know, think about a library. I think one of my favorite authors talks about this. Sherman Alexie in The Absolute True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. They talk about there being a huge library. And in the library are so many books. And in the books are so many words and so many stories. And it's so frustrating that you will never get to read all the books that have ever been written in this world because there simply isn't enough time. And that's how I feel about the stories of all of you out there. There are so many stories and I will never get to know them all. And it drives me crazy, but it's also crazy exciting because there shows how much we get to know. Now, some of you might say, well, my story is not that interesting. And I don't think that's true. I think every single story is interesting. Every single one. Everyone has some story to tell. And so I encourage everybody to tell their stories out there. But that points to something bigger. This idea of there being so much to know and so little time. Now, I've mentioned my Mormon background before, and in Mormonism, we have this sort of theology, which we call eternal progression. This idea that man can be like God. And of course, we embody God usually as a man, although we leave space for a heavenly couple. So there's a mother in heaven as well. And this idea is that our heavenly parents are perfected and we have an eternity to become perfected, to reach nirvana, if you will. And so whenever I would get frustrated with this idea of not knowing all the stories, I used to find patience and healing in this idea that I would have an eternity to learn all of these things. And now I'm not so sure. As I question my Mormon upbringing and I question the myths and the stories that I was given as a child, I don't know if I'll have an eternity, but I do know that I have now. And that's in part why I started this project, because I'm so inspired by all the stories around me. And there are so many stories to tell, and we won't get to all of them, but we will get to some. And one of the stories we're going to talk about today is something that is big and huge and so exciting. And I was going to keep talking about, we're going to move into the Paleo-Indians and the pre-Columbian and Andean cultures to talk about how the Americas were formed, because the stories there are fantastic. And as we move throughout human history in this sort of chronological, if you can do it in a chronological way, we're going to tell all these exciting stories. But I'm going to veer back to more of the beginning of the series again, because recently, right now, it's September 2015. And in September 2015, the news broke just last week with a story of a new species of hominids that have been discovered. And of course, you know, the news lit up about it because the story is breaking everything we know up about science. And when I think about all those libraries in the book that we'll never know, and all those stories out there that I'll never get to hear, that's what, you know, archaeology and anthropology is for me. We can unearth a little piece of the puzzle, but the puzzle is huge because it's a puzzle that includes billions and billions of hominids and humans and people living lives. And we will never get to know all their stories, but we get to know some of them. And what we do know is that in the past 2 years, a bunch of bones that were buried deep within a South African cave were discovered, possibly showing us a new species of hominid, Homo naledi. Now, the Homo naledi is very primitive, so it reminds us of Lucy. Remember, we talked about our ancestor Lucy, who was an Australopithecine. And there's some debate whether the Homo naledi will be Australopithecine or hominid or where it fits in the genus, because it has a tiny brain and ape-like shoulders for climbing, but a lot of it really, resemble women. So let's talk about these bones. The story goes that about 2 years ago, there were two hardcore cavers. Their names were Stephen Tucker and Rick Hunter, and they loved to go caving, and they heard about a cave called Rising Star, and it's about 30 miles northwest of Johannesburg. And Rising Star has been this popular cave since the 1960s because it has channels and caverns that are well mapped. And so Steve Tucker and Rick Hunter were hoping to explore some maybe less known parts of the cave. When someone heard that they were going in there, there was a man named Lee Berger. He's a paleoanthropologist, and he had been interested in this area for a long time. Now, the Rising Star Cave is right smack dab in the cradle of humanity, as we call it, where they're discovering fossils all the time. And Lee Berger was, in 2008, walking with his 9-year-old son when they discovered fossils. And he has been trying to sort of break out of the mold of where different fossils land on the evolution scale. And sometimes he's been criticized for that, but he's been, theorizing that there are more species out there. And so, of course, he tells these cavers to look out for that. Cavers do. And it turns out they find some bones. Now they bring in a team. They start researching this. And what's really cool is this cave yields about 1,500 specimens of bones and teeth. And that's just a fraction of the material at the site, but it's the largest assemblage of human fossils ever found. They just kept finding body after body after body. And the strange thing is all the bodies are buried in the same place. Now, buried is an interesting term, and we're going to talk about that soon. Of course, these bones are unlike anything they've ever seen before, which leads them to know that this is a new species of hominid, and they term it Homo naledi. And it's crazy. It makes the news. These fossils are everywhere, and the reconstruction of the fossils are everywhere, and they reconstruct it to look like, the closest thing that it reminds me of is like the Planet of the Apes. This is what Homo naledi looks like to me. But the most fascinating thing about this story is some of the people that helped with the dig. Now, because of the nature of this cave, it is so tiny and so hard to enter this chamber where these cavers, got into, that when they started this dig, they had really specific requirements. They needed smaller bodies. They needed good scientists who knew the science. And what they ended up with was a team of people, and 6 of them were women, and they are called the underground astronauts. Now, these 6 women are awesome, and I am over the moon about this, that they have decided to come on and tell their stories and share about a little bit about them and their experience in the Rising Star Cave. This is exciting, and I hope that you will share this and you will share their story. These women need to be remembered. They have made incredible history, not just because of what they discovered, but for who they are and what they did. It's fantastic. We're going to be bringing many of them on according to their schedules and doing sort of a mini series in the next little bit. And then we'll go and move on to the pre-Columbian era, which we're going to move towards. But I'm so excited. I want to introduce you first to Hannah Morris. Now, Hannah Morris is an archaeologist who has been studying how plants and humans interact. Her research is fascinating. She got a bachelor's degree from the University of Georgia and a master's from Ohio State University, and is working on her PhD at the University of Georgia. And she's been on digs all over the world. She has a great story. So I'm going to let her tell you about her experience. And then in the next few weeks, we're going to bring on some of the other underground astronauts. I'm really excited about this. So let's meet Hannah.
Hi, I'm Hannah Mars. I am one of the six underground astronauts who were responsible for recovering the remains of Homo naledi from the Naledi chamber in the Rising Star expedition in South Africa. I'm actually an archaeologist, and currently I'm a PhD student at the University of Georgia in the Integrative Conservation Program in the School of Forestry.
So how did you end up involved in this project? I know that National Geographic originally put an ad out because they needed certain body types to be able to work on this project. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I was actually working with the American Museum of Natural History. I was out in the field on a dig, and I came in from work one day, and I fired up my computer and logged into Facebook, because even archaeologists use Facebook. And I saw an unusual job posting from Lee Berger in South Africa, and it was a little mysterious and kind of vague, and it was asking for individuals who had a combination of skills, including caving and climbing expertise, and who also had extensive archaeological excavation experience. So I have I've been an archaeologist for a while, and I've excavated in some pretty crazy situations. And the whole thing just sounded like a great adventure to me. So I sent Lee my CV, and gosh, it was just a couple of weeks later that I was actually on a plane to South Africa.
That's fantastic. And again, you know, we have given listeners a context to exactly what happened on the dig. But let's back up a little bit. I want to know more about you and why archaeology. What got you interested? You know, I grew up super obsessed with Indiana Jones, right? I wanted to be Indiana Jones as a kid, but I never did it. So what made you become an archaeologist?
Well, I actually wanted to be a paleontologist for a long time. My dad is a geologist. He's a geology professor, and he teaches a field course out in Wyoming every year. And so I've grown up going out into the field with him every summer. And one year we actually got to take part in a dinosaur dig. And I can still remember that first dig that I was on, and they literally had to drag me away at the end of the day. I just loved sitting there and picking away at the bone and just finding something new that had never been seen before. So I was really interested in paleontology, and I went off to college, and I thought that's what I was going to do. And then I took an introduction to anthropology course, and I learned about archaeology, and it sounded a heck of a lot like what I had, you know, done in Wyoming, except I would be digging up humans or things that humans had made. And it suddenly occurred to me that humans were a lot more interesting than dinosaurs. So after that, I was hooked. I took more classes and went out into the field after I graduated. And it's been a blast. I've loved every minute of it.
That's fantastic. Did you ever find it challenging being a woman in the field?
You know, there's actually a lot of women in archaeology, which is really great. There's more and more women in anthropology and archaeology each year, it seems. Of course, there are a lot of issues that face women in academia and in the workplace, not just in, you know, archaeology. And so those things are of concern. But for me personally, it's been a pretty good experience.
Fantastic. Well, you guys have made history. You're all over the news right now. And so I really appreciate you coming on to talk about this. But let's talk about the fossils a little bit and the process. First of all, why the term underground astronauts?
Yeah, so Lee kind of dubbed us the underground astronauts. And that's a reference to just how inaccessible this chamber that we were excavating in was. So I can kind of take you into the cave if you'd like, and that'll give you a sense of how remote this actual fossil chamber is.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, when you enter the cave, you go through a series of kind of long, narrow hallways, and there's a couple of steps that you descend that will take you deeper underground. You come to a tall ladder, it's about 5 or 6 feet high, and so you have to climb down this ladder, and you go through another narrow hallway and another step down. And then you're actually at the first constriction of the cave, and that's called Superman's Crawl, which is a small tunnel in the floor of the cave. It's not very long, maybe 10 feet or so, but in some places it's only about 10 inches high. So it's called Superman's Crawl because some of the larger members of our team, especially the men, have to actually put one hand above their head and the other kind of down to their side, like they're getting into the Superman position to get their shoulders through this tunnel. So you crawl through the tunnel, and then you're in a larger chamber, and you're actually at the base of Dragon's Back at that point. And Dragon's Back is this tall, narrow underground ridge. So at this point, we put on our climbing harnesses, and we clip into some safety lines, and we actually climb 20 meters up the back of this underground ridge. And at that point, we're at the top of the chute, which this is where this famous 18-centimeter squeeze is. So when you are descending through the chute, you're climbing down about 12 meters, 12 vertical meters. And I'm one of the taller members of our team, so I really only fit into the chute one way, and I have to kind of pretzel my arms and legs and find just the right nooks and crannies to put my hands and my feet in. And in some places, I can't actually even look down to where I'm placing my hands or my feet because I can't turn my head in the chute because my helmet is getting stuck. It's that narrow in some places. Now, at the very bottom of the chute, there's actually a 4-meter drop to the floor of the chamber. And I can kind of lodge my chest into this last crack. And as I exhale, my feet kind of dangle below me, trying to find a foothold on the wall of the cave or on the ladder that was built inside the chamber. And I can lower myself down inch by inch until I can finally find that foothold and then make that final descent into the Dentaletti chamber where the fossils are located. So you can tell it in some ways you might as well be on the moon. You're 30 to 40 minutes away from the surface. You're 30 meters underground. And the only way that we had to communicate with the people on the surface was actually some telephone and video lines that the volunteer cavers rigged throughout this, this system so that we could actually have contact with Lee and the other senior scientists who were above ground.
I'm not going to lie, that sounds terrifying. I'm looking at a map of it right now, and it's this little labyrinth. How did they ever decide that there was going to be anything in this cave to begin with?
Well, this cave is in the Rising Star system, which is a cave that's been used recreationally for many, many years. And if you're actually on the surface here, you can look across the road and you can see Sterkfontein, which is one of the more well-known paleoanthropological sites in South Africa. So we are right in the middle of the cradle of humankind. So there's lots of fossils in these caves. And the recreational cavers, Rick and Steve, and by the way, when I say recreational cavers, these guys are amazing. This is not just a hobby for them, it's a passion. These are the kind of guys who go into caves called Armageddon. So they're hardcore cavers. And they had been told by their friend Pedro to kind of keep an eye out for fossils that might be hominin fossils. So they were out one weekend doing a little quote-unquote recreational caving, and they specifically wanted to see if there was any place in the Rising Star system that they hadn't found, they hadn't been before. So I believe Steve was actually the one to first kind of notice the chute and make his way down there, and Rick followed him right after.
All my anthropologists friends are geeking out that I'm talking to you, and they said, please ask about the burial deposits. There's some question whether this cave is actually a fossil burial site. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to talk about that. Now, in the scientific papers, we actually use the phrase, they were intentionally deposited here. So in trying to work through and understand how these fossils actually came to be in this chamber, we've looked at a lot of hypotheses. So we've considered, could these fossils have been dug in by predators? That's a manner in which fossil hominins and other animal remains often find themselves in caves in South Africa. But there's no marks of predation. There's no, you know, teeth marks, claw marks on any of these bones, nothing like that to indicate that they were actually killed or drug into this cave by a carnivore. We've also, of course, tried to understand the geology of the cave and if it's changed over time. So we've had geologists who have searched above and below ground trying to see if there are other entrances, if maybe this fossil chamber was more accessible to the surface at one point. And we haven't found any evidence of that. And that's supported also by the fact that we don't find any bones except hominin bones. There have been, I think there were 6 or 7 owl bones that were towards the surface of this deposit and a couple of rodent teeth, but no other animals, which you would expect if this chamber had been open to the surface or closer to the surface throughout its history. And again, in other caves, in southern Africa, when you find fossil hominins, you often find other animals that were using the cave for refuge or trying to find water. And we just don't see that same pattern here. So we've also looked at the hypothesis that this was a mass casualty event, but it does seem that there's some time in between when these bodies are deposited. We don't exactly know how long, but it does look like these bodies built up over time. They didn't necessarily all die at the same time.
Why is it important that it was a burial versus just, you know, a mass casualty? What would that mean about these early people?
Right. Well, we're kind of left with this hypothesis that these bodies were intentionally disposed of. And to be clear too, we're not necessarily using the word burial in the sense that we use it today. We're not saying that these hominins drug in a dead member of their family or their social group and, you know, said mass or sat shiva or anything like that. We're just saying that these individuals were intentionally deposited after they were dead in this location. And that's really interesting because we think really that humans, that Homo sapiens are the only animals that do that. And these hominins are not us. They're not humans and they're exhibiting a behavior that we normally think only humans do.
Yeah. And I've heard people kind of dance around the term missing link, right? Do you want to talk about why it's important to avoid that term at this point?
Yeah, sure. I'll give you the best kind of short answer that I can. And again, maybe this might be one of those questions for some of the other real paleoanthropologists. So when people talk about the missing link, I think the reason that we as archaeologists and paleoanthropologists don't necessarily like that term is because it's really the wrong question to ask. There's probably no one missing link. There might be missing links, but to say that any one find might be the missing link is to really take a very linear view of human or hominin evolution. And we don't think that's really the way that it worked. Some people describe the hominin family tree. In recent years, people have talked more in terms of a bush and using a bush as a metaphor. And lately, Lee has even been talking about a braided stream as a metaphor for hominin evolution. So if there ever was a missing link, there'll be more than one. There'll be lots of missing links.
Well, that's fantastic. Why does this find shake up the scientific world?
This find is really important because, first of all, it's a new species in our genus, in the genus Homo, and it has this really interesting set of characteristics that we've never seen before, all in one hominin. Of course, the other reason that Homo naledi and the Rising Star expedition has been so important and will continue to tell us so much about human evolution and our origins is simply the size of the assemblage. So we have 15 individuals spanning a range of ages from very young infants to very old individuals who are towards the end of their life. And that's really going to tell us a lot about that's really going to tell us a lot about the growth and development of these hominins.
I used people. I need to edit that out too. It's so hard.
Yeah, it is hard.
Before I let you go, because I'm going to talk to some of your colleagues and we're going to talk more about the analysis and what this means, but I'm really interested in you and the work that you're doing. So do you want to tell us about maybe your favorite memory on the dig, and then you can tell us about some projects that you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. Okay, my favorite moment on the dig. That's going to be hard.
Please tell me that it's like the life of an archaeologist. There's booby traps and big, you know, stones rolling after you, saving the golden idol.
Oh, no, nothing like that. We did have kind of one interesting day when there were earthquakes happening in Johannesburg. And you know, Lee sat us down. He took us aside away from the cameras and everything. And he sat us down and we had a conversation about if we were going to go into the cave or not. And of course, he said, you know, it's your choice. You don't have to go in today. And we talked about it and we talked about the pros and cons and what would happen if there was an earthquake and something inside the cave shifted. And, I'll never forget. Lee said, I will come after you. He said, we will get you out, which was very comforting. And of course we all went in, we couldn't stay out. Probably one of my favorite moments was, it was sometime in the first week, and those first couple of days were just such a blur because we thought at the beginning, you know, when I landed in Johannesburg, all I knew was that we were going after what might be the most complete hominin skeleton that had ever been found. And again, I'm not a paleoanthropologist, but I knew that was pretty huge. And then, of course, after the first day or two, we realized we had two individuals, and then it was three, and then it was four. And there was this one day where I was one of the last excavators in the cave, and I came out, and it was getting late in the afternoon, and most everyone else had gone down to the tent area to clean up or grab some food. And Lee was, as usual, waiting in the command center. He always waited for everybody to get out at the end of the day. And I came up and he gave me a hug and he smiled and he just said, we've got another one today. And at that point it must have been five or six individuals. And I just kind of gave a tired laugh and turned to walk back down to my tent and wash my face and get some food. And I made it maybe about halfway down this little path before, I never necessarily thought I would experience this, but my legs just gave out from underneath me and I had to just sit there on the ground. And I don't remember how long I sat there, but that's when it really, really hit me that, just the magnitude and the impact of what we were doing and the fact that, we were excavating, you know, at that point, six individuals, which no one had ever dreamed that that would have been possible. And even then we knew that it was really going to change the way that we think about human evolution. And I was just so honored to be able to be, just have a small part in that, that it was just completely overwhelming. But of course, you know, you can't hold that thought in your mind all the time. So the next day it was just back to work.
I just want to tell you that I think that this is incredible and you're incredible. And it's just such an exciting thing. I think of my daughter and all of our daughters out there. You are giving them an example to look forward to, something to be excited about. And, you know, this tying, the work that you're doing, tying us back to who we were, it's just incredible. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been an amazing adventure. And, I don't think I've ever worked with a team that was, so just completely dedicated to the science and to getting people involved and excited about science. And it's just been the most incredible experience I've ever had.
Do you want to tell us of anything you're working on now?
Sure. So I I'm a PhD student in a program called the Integrative Conservation Program here at UGA, and I'm working with a restoration ecologist, a plant ecologist. So my interests in archaeology actually relate to plant remains from archaeological sites. Although bones are very cool, you know, plants are what really do it for me. So I work on St. Catherine's Island, Georgia, which is a barrier island off the coast of Georgia. And I'm going to be looking at land use over the past 600 years or so. So the site was first occupied by Native Americans 4,000 years ago. But in the 16th century, the Spanish arrived and they built a mission. And that's when the particular site and location that my research focuses on, that's when it was first inhabited. And there have been a series of different strategies for how to manage this landscape. And so I'm really going to be diving deep into how people make decisions about land use and how those decisions affect ecosystem functioning and plant communities, and what we can learn from the past to maybe help us deal with some of the changes that are coming that will be related to anthropogenic climate change and its effect on vegetation.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Hannah Morris is part of a larger story. She's one page in the Naledi story, if you will, but an important one. And when you think of her story and her life and all the work that she has yet to do, it's so inspiring to think about. There's so much knowledge out there. We get to live it. We get to live and spend our lives knowing and learning more and more. And that's so exciting to me. I just get so nerdy excited about it. So I'm so glad we got to hear part of Hannah's story. And we're going to bring Hannah back on to talk more about the pre-Columbian life and complex human hunter-gatherer societies. So stay tuned for that. But for now, thanks for listening to another episode of Story of Woman Podcast. The Story of Woman podcast is brought to you by Bluehost. Consider telling your own story and sign up with Bluehost. If you go onto thestoryofwoman.org and look on the right-hand side, there's a Bluehost button right there for you. Click on it and set up your own site to tell your story. Special thanks to Lady Murasaki, who provides us amazing music. Check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you hear today, consider supporting the podcast at storyofwoman.org. We take donations that support the telling of women's stories. Consider a donation at storyofwoman.org.